Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners, industry leaders, directors, all who have been kind enough to give up some of their time to share their stories of personal and professional growth. This week, Adam and I are joined by Ketan Desai. Ketan is the CMO at Luvolta Pharmaceuticals. Ketan, it wasn't long ago that you and I first connected. Well, for those of you that aren't familiar with you or the company, give us a quick intro as to, who you are and what Luvolta Pharmaceuticals is all about.
Yeah, I'm an immunologist and rheumatologist by training, and I've been in the industry for about 22, 23 years so far. And I went through the school of Big Pharma, GSK, and then Aventis. Mm-hmm. And then in 2006, I got the entrepreneurial bug and I started my own companies. Yeah. And so I have three companies now and I wear many hats. Luvolta is just one of them. So I'm the chief, I'm the co-founder of Luvolta and mm-hmm. also the inventor of all the products in its pipeline. Yeah. And I also have two other companies, a radiology company and a dermatology, a cosmetics company. Okay. So that's what I'm doing right now. And I divide my time between those three when I'm not writing.
Sure. So when you're not writing, did you say?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Well, writing, I mean, you've got me curious here. What sort of writing? We're not talking medical writing, I don't think.
No, so I write for investment websites. It's called talkmarkets.com, and I mainly talk about investing in biotech companies. And I'm also a published author. I have a book. It's a thriller. It's on, called Germs of War. It's on Amazon. If you want to read a thriller and you're at the airport getting bored.
Very nice indeed. We'll have to tag those on the show notes. I guess on the subject of, kind of our normal running order here, you say that you've been in the industry for 20 plus years. And as I ask kind of all of our guests, really, to take you way back to the beginning, I mean, how did you get into this world of clinical research and pharma?
Yeah, so when I finished med school in India, I knew I didn't want to practice medicine. It just did not appeal to me. Mm. And so I was looking for alternative careers. And in India at that time, there were not too many alternative careers for an MD. So I came to the US to do research. My initial goal was to do research on HIV. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Mayo Clinic for a year. And then from there, I went and did my PhD, cellular molecular biology. And then after that, everybody told me, you're an MD, you should do a residency and fellowship, otherwise your MD will go waste. And so I did that. Mm-hmm. I did my residency at WashU in St. Louis, which is one of the top five programs in the country. And then I also did a fellowship in immunology. And then I came back to my original goal, which is, so I'm basically where I was when I finished med school. Now what do I do? And so I was thinking of going into academia and going into research, but the idea of writing grants and asking for money just did not appeal to me. Mm-hmm. And so I went into industry by design and not by default. I actively sought out an industry position. I joined a CRO to make sure that I actually liked it. And I found I liked the industry. And then I went to Smith Klein Beecher.
Wow. Okay. I guess a lot of it was very much by design there, including a move from over in India. I mean, how was that when you decided that was the route that you were going to go to and, move to the Western world and the States and whatever? How did your friends, family and kind of people close to you at that time react?
Well, it was actually pushed a lot by my father. By that time, my sister had migrated to UK. Yeah. She had been living in UK for about 7-8 years by that time. Mm. And my brother had already migrated to the US. So for me, it was kind of a path already laid down.
Yeah.
The difference is my brother is an IIT graduate. So he was an engineer. So that is different. Mm-hmm. And so for a medical guy, either you have to take the medical entrance test for getting into residency programs. But that wasn't what I was interested in that time. I wanted to do research. So I applied to several programs in the United States for research, and Mayo is the one that gave me the offer. So I took it.
Mm-hmm. Fine. So, do you remember those early days? So you started out with a CRO and then went to Smith Klein Beecham, you say?
Correct.
What was your specific job title back then? What were you doing?
So I started off actually quite low on the totem pole. I started off in regulatory affairs. And at that time, when I first started, I did not even know what IND stood for and MDA stood for. It was that, I mean, I was that green. And so the first year and a half was a very steep learning curve. And especially in the CRO, which, you know, you're exposed to pretty much all phases of trials and all different therapeutic areas, it was a fantastic learning experience. So within a year and a half, I learned what, you know, you would learn 4 or 5 years in a regular pharma company. And so when I went to Smith Kline Beecham in the rheumatology division, I was a director at that point, and I already knew how to do things after a year.
Wow. Okay. And look, was there any particular mentors or managers or, you know, senior individuals that kind of guided that path to that move?
I wouldn't say guided.
Kind of, again,
there were
by
people...
design from
no,
your
I
end.
Wouldn't say any of them guided me. There were several I interacted with, but no one really guided me.
Okay. And then look, from there, clearly, you know, we're now talking to you about your current title, Chief Medical Officer. It's a very lofty one. It's the heights that a lot of people are looking to reach. And I recently had an education on just how much education is involved, how much training, how much, you know, devotion has to go into this. Could you talk us through that path from, you know, starting out in kind of regulatory affairs, bottom of the totem pole, to kind of how you've progressed to where you are now?
Yeah, so the next part of my training was at Aventis after I left Smith Kline. So there was a merger of Smith Kline and Glaxo. And then, as fate would have it, after the merger took place, all the oncologists pretty much got up and left and joined another company. So I left rheumatology at Smith Kline and basically picked up the whole oncology portfolio.
Wow.
And so I learned how to do, you know, they basically carry the whole department on my shoulders, so to speak. And then when I, you know, had enough of oncology and there was a more senior title available at Sanofi, actually Aventis in those days, I moved to Aventis. And so there I had the whole therapeutic area under me, all the studies. So at that point, you know, you look at everything coming out of preclinical, going into phase 1, phase 2 and 3, the actual execution, and then giving support to medical affairs for phase 4 studies. So that covers the entire gamut from preclinical to phase 4 studies. So you have to deal with everybody from the clinical, preclinical scientists to the phase 1 program, how to make sure that the phase 2A proof of concept study is sufficient to then go on to phase 2B or phase 3. And then once a drug is marketed, what post-marketing studies need to be done? You have to interact with KOLs and do all that kind of stuff, including publication strategies.
Yeah.
So that is the whole gamut of things that takes place. So Aventis actually gave me a very good background to be able to become a CMO, because that's what a CMO does. We handle everything from preclinical to make sure what is done is scientifically accurate and relevant in the clinic. We make sure that what is being done in the clinic will get an approval. We have to deal with commercial folks to make sure that what they're doing in the clinic is actually commercially viable. I mean, there's no point developing a drug that the commercial folks can't sell. And then afterwards, and then we have to deal with regulatory people to make sure that the studies endpoints are accepted by the authorities and will lead to approval. And then finally, after approval takes place, how to support marketing in making the drug a blockbuster, or at least a very successful one. So that's what CMO does. We have our fingers in all pies. I forgot to mention one thing, which is also very important, is CMC. That's chemistry, manufacturing, and controls. So almost sometimes half the cost of a study is the supply of the study material. And so we have to coordinate with the CMC folks to make sure that we're getting the study drugs in a timely fashion, in a properly blended manner, so that we can do the study properly.
Wow. So look, I guess you picked up a lot of that from Aventis and Sanofi. I mean, how it sounds like, as you said, there was a lot of weight on your shoulders there. How many people were you kind of like managing in that process? Like if you were to include all of the cross-functional teams?
Yeah. Aventis was an extremely lean organization. It came across from the merger of RPR and HMR. One of the German company, there was a French company. And so by the time the merger took place, more than half the people left. So it was an extremely lean organization, and we did things mainly through CROs.
Right.
And I think it was Quintiles that was the preferred CRO because they bought the previous Aventis site in Kansas City. And so we did a lot of stuff through Quintiles. Our teams were extremely small. I had only one or two CRAs, one person in regulatory, one person in data management, one person in stats. So it wasn't a really big team. But the
Right.
extended team, which included the CROs, that became really big.
I see, I see.
I'm just curious, Ketan. You know, coming into the industry, similarly to yourself, I started in CRO world as well, and you tend to be exposed from the ground up to all the activities, don't you? And it's
right.
a fairly sink or swim environment.
Yes.
Sounds like you swam very rapidly, as James was indicating. But it's interesting. We have a lot of listeners from all manner on all areas of clinical research. Is there any particular advice you'd give them coming into this industry? Because one thing that strikes me listening to you as well is really just reinforcing the point that CROs is where you really cut your teeth, isn't it? Was that, you know, is that the advice you'd give to others coming into this industry?
Well, it really depends on what your goal is. If you want to be extremely focused and narrow in what you're going to do in the rest of your life, then it's perfectly fine to go into big pharma right from the beginning. So for example, if you want to do only one therapeutic area, let's say you want to be a rheumatologist and rheumatologist only, you want to do clinical trials and clinical trials only, you don't want to look left, right, up, down, anywhere else, then big pharma is fine because you can get put into a silo and you're fine in that silo. And there are all these other people who will help you out in that silo. But if you want to get a broad exposure, you want to learn everything, then it's better to go, I would say you have to go to CRO, you can go to a small biotech or some other places also. But you know, the more exposure you get, the more viable you become. And it's more interesting too, otherwise it gets boring to do the same thing over and over again.
Yes, I think it's great advice. And I would probably say the same to others as well, because where I did my most learning was in early phase, in setting up a couple of early phase clinical trial units.
Yeah.
And similarly, the people that you bring in then seem to stay with you along the journey as well, don't they? And I wonder if that's also been the case for you in your career.
Yeah, it happens. But, you know, I've been through some of the smaller biotechs where some of them have failed mainly because they ran out of funding. And so the people then tend to disappear after that.
Awesome stuff. Well, that gives us, I guess, a very good insight as to your background and kind of how you've progressed. Look, I'm then always interested to know, at what point was it? Do you remember like the day where that entrepreneurial bug hit you and you thought, you know what, it's time for a change?
Yeah, so a little bit of background about India here. So I come from the west coast of India, with a small state called Gujarat. And we are supposed to be one of the most entrepreneurial people on the planet. Actually, if you read The Economist, there is an article about Gujaratis in The Economist, if you ever look at that. So I had those genes in me anyway. They were just looking for a right time to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2006, when I was with this other company, small biotech company, and at that point I said, you know what, I can do a better job myself. And so that's what I did. I did a better job myself and I started my own company. So I started one company, which was purely by accident. One of my friends was another company. She was down in Texas. She was looking to find somebody who could read the x-rays and MRIs for her oncology clinical trials. And she came to me and said, can you find somebody in India who can do that? Because it would be cheaper. And I said, sure. I didn't have anybody. So I picked up the phone, called my friends. They found somebody there. We went there, we started the site, and we did the study. And then I said, you know what, this is a good gig. I should just continue it.
Yeah.
And so I had another friend who introduced me to some of the key KOLs in rheumatology. And I've been doing studies ever since.
Wow.
And that was in 2006, 16 years ago.
Wow. Okay. And what was that LaVolta or was that one of the other companies? Because you mentioned three companies.
Yeah, so that was my first company, IMC Radiology.
Right. Okay.
And then, so I also started my consulting company at that time in 2006, because I obviously couldn't be working for one company and having my own company on the side. That would be a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
And so I started my consulting company and then I started inventing stuff. So when I was at, I was consulting for Novartis. And Novartis has a compound called zoledronic acid. It is used for treatment of osteoporosis and Titus disease, excuse me, and also for hypercalcemia of malignancy. And Amgen had a product that came out at that time called Prolia. And Prolia was pointing out that zoledronic acid has a lot of side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were trying to find a way to mitigate that. They were going to go the sub-Q route versus IV. And I said, why don't you just combine this with prednisolone, because that will counter the side effects. And they told me, no, we're not interested. I said, okay, then is it okay with you if I take this forward? And they said, yeah, you can do whatever you want. Because, you know, technically the patent belonged to them.
Yeah.
So they were not interested. So I filed a patent and I started this. I did a trial on my own. It was a trial in osteoporosis. And it was a small number of patients. And the patients had no side effects at all with the combination.
Wow.
But they also told me that their osteoarthritis pain became better. So I switched gears and I started this company, Livolta, to treat osteoarthritis pain with the combination of methylprednisolone and zoledronic acid. And we have finished two phase two studies now, and we're going to phase three.
Wow. Wow. Sounds like a lot of the time you just pick things up and run with it then. Kate, yeah. And then kind of managed to make a success about it, even from your friend saying, oh, do you know anyone over in India? And you kind of just saying, I'm going to say yes, and then work it out afterwards.
Yeah.
Typical entrepreneur.
Yeah, you know, when opportunity strikes, I take it. I don't hesitate. I don't second guess. I take and run with it.
Awesome stuff. So let's talk about Livolta then, which I believe is now the main company for yourself, if I'm correct. So in terms of Livolta, I guess, look, I often get questions about where our company name came from. So you had a few, you know, been involved in a few things prior to that, but where did the name come from for Livolta? Has it got anything to do with the company's mission, or is it something weird and wacky? Where did that come from?
It's a brainwave. The lightning,
mm-hmm.
Volt means electricity, and so Livolta yep. is electricity.
Ah, okay.
Brainwave.
I see. So look, I guess let's talk Livolta now. You know, you started that when, what year was Livolta started?
So officially, I think 2014.
2013. So that's been going quite a few years now. When you started that, was that just yourself, or was there other individuals that you had managed to rope in through kind of the years of experience that you had picked up at that point?
Yeah, so we need to go back a little bit. So when I was working for that company in Minnesota, I told you about, I was a chief medical officer.
Yeah.
They were using something called beta-glucan that comes from yeast to do their studies. And I thought that was a very good idea from an immunological point of view. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think that was very viable from a commercial point of view. So I actually went and did a high-throughput screening on my own dime. It cost me $40,000. And I found some molecules that would do the same thing given orally. These are called SYK inhibitors, S-Y-K.
Mm-hmm.
And so I filed a patent, and my wife was available. So I said, guess what? You're the CEO of this company called IMC Biotechnology.
Right.
And so she started a lab, and she took this compound forward through preclinical. And then we merged my zoledronic acid company with her company called IMC Biotechnology to make this company called Livolta. So she came in with those products, and she's a chief scientific officer. And then we hired, the two of us hired Rich Becker, who's the CEO.
Wow. I love that. I mean, you know, I run my business with my partner. I know that Adam has tried to rope in his missus to do various bits of work from time
to
time.
She does great work for me as well. And isn't that interesting that we also have all that in common as well?
Yeah.
How do you find that, Clayton? I mean, for me, some of my friends say, I just don't know how you do it. You know, you live and work together. Like, do you not ever get a break? And we're like, no, but we like it that way. Like, we get on well. We worked together before we were together. How do you find it? And is there any tips that you would have for people when working with their partner?
Yeah, separation of church and state. So during from 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in her case,
yeah.
I start working at 4 a.m. and I finish at 4 p.m.
Yeah.
She starts at about 8 a.m. and she finishes at 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. But during those hours, it's business. There's no personal stuff going on. And then after 5 o'clock, it's personal time. There's no business after that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, unless it's really important, we don't interfere with each other.
Clear divide there.
It's interesting because we also have an unspoken rule, and my wife and I, we didn't get together through our work, but we also worked for a number of CROs together, and we had that rule as well, which was when it was at work or we were in the car commuting to and from work, that was the time. When we were at home, it never got discussed, and that's how it's played out now. I'm pointing towards my house at the other end of the garden, but that's exactly how it plays out now, funnily enough, Kato. And I loved your description, separating, what did you say, church and state.
Church and state, yeah.
That's brilliant. I'll share that with her. She'll love that.
Awesome stuff. So look, I guess in terms of that, then it sounds like, again, you're operating quite a lean operation. There's yourself, there's your wife, there's Rich, who you mentioned is the CEO. Where are you at in terms of your trials and studies? How many trials do you have running? How big's the operation now?
At the moment, we don't have trials. We're getting ready to go into phase three. And so we are in the fundraising mode for phase three.
Yeah.
So we had a meeting with the FDA. They wanted us to do two phase three studies. So that's what we're fundraising for.
Okay. And how is that fundraising side of things? Because I recall you mentioning earlier that, you know, you didn't necessarily want to go into academia because you hated the idea of having to ask for money. However, probably one of the biggest challenges for any founder or, you know, anything to do with clinical research is typically raising money, asking for money and getting those investors. So have you turned your opinion on that somewhat, or is it just one of the necessary evils to allow you to do what you need to do?
So the main fundraising is not done by me. Renee does a lot of it and Rich does some of it.
Yeah.
Renee does a lot of it, especially she is still the chair of Women in Bio, the Philadelphia chapter.
All
and
right.
She has a lot of connections through that. So she introduces us to a lot of people.
Mm.
Rich also hires a lot of people to do fundraising. So they'll take a percentage of whatever comes in from that point of view. And he goes to these events like Bio and stuff like that, or JP Morgan. Those are, you know, almost like a matchmaking events. You go in for 15 minutes each and you talk to somebody.
Yeah. So you've managed to, despite kind of being the catalyst that's put a lot of this together, you've managed to steer clear of that bit that you wanted to steer clear of all of those years ago.
Yeah, I do a little bit, but not much. Nothing like what Renee does, for example.
Fair play. And look, I guess, how have things changed then, I guess, since the early days? You know, we've been through COVID. You know, we're kind of the other side of COVID now. What's changed within the business since kind of kicking things off in 2013, 2014 to now 10 years on?
I think the biggest change has been this whole concept of decentralized clinical trials. Whatever that means, I don't know. It seems to mean different thing to different people.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the biggest change. And people are more willing to interact, not in person. So you don't have to go to office that much. Zoom calls, etc., seem to be working a lot more. Mm-hmm. Those are the two biggest changes. And of course, now that AI is coming in, that's going to make a difference in the future, both in terms of drug discovery and trials, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And look, I guess, on that subject of decentralized trials, and you're saying, you know, different people make different things of it, what's your understanding of the concept? I'm always trying, you know, again, I'm running a recruitment business. It's such a buzzword. I hear it left, right, and center. So I'm always interested to find out what the professionals make of it, you know, different viewpoints, because as you say, they can differ.
Yeah, it is a buzzword, and I'm not sure I'm totally on board with it. Mm. So to some people, it means that you don't have the patient go to the site and rather have the site go to the patient, for example.
Yeah.
Or that you don't have, or you almost have satellite clinics where a patient can go to without going to the PI.
Mm.
I guess that may work in rural areas where our patient doesn't have transportation. But for the most part, you know, if you're living in a major city, that is not an issue.
Gotcha.
And have you given some thought to these phase three studies that you described as to how you might plan those visits, or, you know, do you intend for them to be around a particular key opinion leader or a PI of your choice? Is that your thoughts?
Yeah, so in osteoarthritis, the studies are so simple. It's so incredibly easy to do. So we have questionnaires like WOMAC pain, WOMAC function. And really, you can do them over the phone if you need to. So you can have a baseline visit and you can have an end of study visit. And because zoledronic acid is so well characterized, I don't need to do chemistries and UA, et cetera, et cetera. It's all pretty well noted in the literature. So technically, I could do a one visit at screening baseline and one visit at the end of study and do the rest of it totally by phone.
So it sounds like you've already got that plan then for the DCT thing.
Yeah.
Effectively. But your version of DCT. So yeah. Over the phone and maybe patient recorded outcomes via a patient app.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
And the only other thing is, for example, rescue medications, you know, how many did you take?
Yeah.
I mean, I keep that over the phone. I don't need to sit in front of the patient.
Mm.
And the other thing is called visual analog scale when you have a pain scale.
Yeah.
You can have a Zoom thing and just say, you know, on a 0 to 10.
With a line.
Yeah.
You literally put your finger from 0 to 10, don't you? Where's your pain?
Yeah.
How's your pain? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I did not know that that's how it could work. Incredible stuff. Katie, we're kind of touching on, different aspects there, but I guess it sounds like there's been kind of subtle changes. It sounds like there's still some things that you're looking to achieve, but before we get onto kind of your plans for the future, I mean, what would you say has perhaps been your biggest success, other than kind of successfully juggling work with your wife and some close acquaintances, which I always think is a win? What's been the biggest success for yourself and for the business to this point?
Getting the patents in many, many countries.
Mm. And how does it feel when you get those?
It's really good because it validates my inventions, you know.
Mm. I can imagine.
Yeah, so right now I have about 13 patents.
Wow. Incredible stuff. So look, in that case, as I said, look, so what's next for yourselves and Lavolta? You're saying that you're targeting a kind of phase 3, and then where do things go from there for yourselves?
Yeah, so if you get funding in time, we'll obviously do the phase 3, but we've also put Lavolta on the market. So if someone buys it, that's fine too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's as far as Lavolta is concerned. And I have the other company I was mentioning is a cosmetic / dermatology company.
Yeah.
And so there we have 43 claims in our patent, which out of it, 13 or 14 have been approved.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually I hired a CEO just today for that company.
Wow.
And so she's going to take it forward. Most of the drugs are OTC for wrinkles and hair loss and acne and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they can go to the market right away. And then there's only one drug that will need to go through the FDA process.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you are, kind of got your finger on the pulse, doing a few different things. So in terms of kind of what's next for you then personally, Katen, if the Volta's perhaps going to be on the market, it sounds like you're quite easygoing as to what happens. You know, what are your plans? You know, what would be the ideal scenario for you personally over the next couple of years? You know, if you were to list out kind of, this is the dream situation. I do X, Y, and Z with the Volta. This happens. I start a new company. What, it sounds like you're very easygoing. What would be the dream scenario for you?
Well, I can tell you what the dream scenario is for my wife, and maybe that'd be mine too.
it's normally fairly closely aligned, isn't it?
she would like to sell the Volta, and then she would like to travel for a year, and she has got a whole bunch of places in the US and abroad she wants to go to.
Yeah, but it sounds like that may well be on the cards for you, Katen. But look, before we let you go and kind of, keep an eye on your story on LinkedIn to see whether you are soon posting pictures from a around the world trip or something. We always like to close the show with a quick fire questions round. So look, I'll kick us off here and just ask, what is perhaps the number one piece of advice that you would give to your younger self, Katen?
continue to be adventurous.
I like it. Short, sweet. Be very open. Go traveling with the wife. Be adventurous. Adam, over to you.
What is the number one book or resource you would recommend for our audience?
What is the number one what?
Book or resource you would recommend for our audience?
You mean other than my book?
Well, you can shout your book, of course,
yeah,
again.
Give us another shout for your book.
Oh, yeah, it's called Germs of War. So there's a little story behind this, too. When I was doing my fellowship, I was moonlighting in the ER one day, actually urgent care, and I didn't have a single patient. So I said, you know, what can I do? And this was before the internet. And I said, well, why don't I write a book? So I started writing a book. And, you know, I have a military background. I went to Army Medical College. My father was in the Air Force. And then, of course, I have lab background and I have medical background. So I combined the three to write a book on bioterrorism. And so the book on bioterrorism, you know, I made Afghan-based terrorists who attacked the United States and all that stuff. And then 2 years later, 9/11 happened. 2 years after my book came out. Of course, they used planes and all that stuff. But I got interviewed by the CIA so, because they said, well, did you know something we didn't talk about?
That was crazy. Fun. So,
yeah, so, you know, read the book.
You're going to have people curious now. You're going to get some sales there on Amazon. I can see it. Awesome stuff, Caton. And look, coming back to, I guess, kind of our typical questions, you mentioned that you hired someone just yesterday or today, a CEO. Yeah. But look, what are the top three qualities that you value most when putting together your teams or teams for your businesses?
Yeah, number one is experience. Number two is the character. And by character, I mean integrity, honesty, openness. I don't want a yes man, and I don't want someone who's arrogant or egotistical. I want someone who gets the job done, easy to get along with. And in this case, number three was fundraising experience, because I didn't want to do it.
Seeing a theme there, seeing a theme. I like it.
That's very good. That's very good. I think I might know the answer to this, but I'll ask the question anyway. So what is or who is your favorite thing outside of work?
Well, actually, exercising is my favorite.
Exercising?
Yeah.
Anything in specific?
I exercise about an hour a day, 30 minutes lifting weights and about 25 minutes aerobics.
Very good.
Man after my own heart.
Exactly.
And look, finally, Caton, it sounds like you've got your head screwed on. So look, what would you say is your number one golden rule for both life and business, if you were to combine the two there?
Oh, just being happy, that's all.
I like it. So simple. So overlooked at times, though, right?
Right.
Perfect. Well, look, Caton, it's been a pleasure having you on the show to share your story, hear about your book, hear how you're juggling kind of work with your wife, as often Adam and I do. And look, to close the show, for anyone that's looking to reach out to you to find out more about LaVolta, your book, any general questions, what is the best place or way to reach out?
Either through LinkedIn, or if you want, you can share my email address. That's fine too.
Perfect. Well, it will tag you up on everything after the show. But Caton, been an absolute pleasure having you on. And I'll definitely have to keep in touch to hear about the travels that are no doubt on the cards.
Thank you both. It was great being on the show.
You're welcome. Caton.